Check, 1, 2. Check, 1, 2.
Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6... 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Here we are. Ha ha, the day after. What do we call this? I don't know what we'll call this. The Monday Night Massacre? Remember back in the Nixon days, the Saturday night? I don't know what to call this. I want to ask, are you all as pissed off as I am? I'm going to forego the usual niceties that I talk about coming to you from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida and all that today and all the pleasantries and how are you doing and how is the weather and all of that. I am pissed. And I know you are as well. And I think it would be unrealistic to say that, well, that we didn't expect this sometime, but I just didn't think it would be this soon. And I think we now know, as if we had any doubt, that we have a man, the supposed leader of this country, actually he's probably second or third in command after Dick Cheney and I don't know, whoever Dick decides is his second in command. But we have a man in this country that no longer gives a goddamn about what the people in this country think. We have a man supposedly leading this country who doesn't give a goddamn about the Constitution, about the Bill of Rights, about anything that this country stands for. He doesn't care about the rule of law. He doesn't care about justice. He doesn't care about the jury system. He doesn't care about what the guidelines are that the Department of Justice has set down for penalties. He does not care. I respect the jury's verdict, he said. He took that jury's verdict yesterday and wiped his rear end with it. I respect the jury's verdict, but I have concluded that the sentence given to Mr. Libby is excessive. I have concluded that the prison sentence given to Mr. Libby is excessive. Excessive? This was a sentence that was smack dab in the middle of the federal sentencing guidelines drawn up by his own people, and this sentence is excessive? Let's say for a moment that it is excessive, just for argument's sake. Let's just give him that for a moment. How about the 4,000 other people who have applied to the Bush administration for sentence commutation since he's been in office? Weren't some of their sentences excessive as well? I guess not, because he's refused all but three of them. Ah, but you see, none of them were fair-haired boys of Dick Cheney. None of them were on their knees in front of Dick Cheney in Dick Cheney's office, like Scooter Libby. None of them had the power to bring down this administration, like Scooter Libby. If he should have decided to sing and tell the truth, none of them. So those other 4,000 can take their request for sentence commutations and just forget it. Because except for all but three of them, they can go, as we used to say, go piss up a rope, because it just doesn't matter. See, it's only excessive when it involves a pal, a friend, or one of your cronies who happens to be covering your ass. That's when the sentence is excessive. It's excessive when the guy's gone to prison has information that could bring down your whole administration, starting with your very own vice president and almost his entire staff. It's excessive when it involves your very own campaign architect, Mr. Karl Rove, who's in this thing up to his eyeballs, and everybody knows it. Mr. Bush, you said, and let me quote you, you said you would take care, end quote, of anyone who leaked information, classified information in your administration. Well, in this case, you were a man of your word, because you most certainly are taking care of Scooter Libby and giving the American public the finger and a slap in the face to the justice system of the United States. Another Bush administration slap in the face to the Justice Department of the United States. Alberto Gonzalez is the first slap. God, I hate this. I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming. I just didn't think it would come this way. And the excuse for all of this is that there was, in the opinion of the neocon Beltway crowd, and you've heard this said a million times during the past few weeks, there was no underlying crime. Poor Scooter was convicted of lying about a crime that just didn't exist, in their way of thinking. Stop and think about that for a moment, because a more absurd argument has never been made in Washington, and I think we'll all have to agree that there have been some pretty damn wild arguments made in that town over time, but nothing tops that one, that there was no underlying crime involved in this. There was no one found guilty of an underlying crime because Scooter Libby told a mountain of lies that kept Prosecutor Fitzgerald from being able to get to the truth. That's it. Plain and simple. Scooter Libby acted as a shield for the vice president and Karl Rove. There's no other way you can say it. I'm trying to think of a good example. I know there's a perfect example out there somewhere, but me being me, can't come up with it. Let's say, for example, some guy walks into a bank and he pulls off a holdup, okay? He sticks a gun in the face of the loan teller who's in the bank, all right? Small bank, small town. One teller, and the way banks do business nowadays, it wouldn't be unusual to see one teller in a large bank in a large town, but that's another story for another day. But he sticks a gun in the face of a loan teller who, by the way, is a friend of this robber and who's in on this deal. And he makes off with $50,000 of the bank's money. And so the cops suspect him, and they bring him in for questioning. And his teller friend lies and said, no, I've never seen this guy before in my life. He's not the one who robbed me. Well, the cops have to let the guy go, their suspect, right? They got to let him go. They can't solve the crime, and no one is ever charged with robbing that bank. Because the teller lied and refused to identify a guy who knew robbed him, does that mean the bank wasn't robbed? Does that mean there was no underlying crime just because the teller, a friend of the robber, wouldn't identify him for the cops and the whole thing gets dropped for lack of evidence? Tell me how the Scooter Libby case is any different than that. Tell me that when the cops interviewed the bank teller and were told that he never saw the robber before in his life, that he wasn't committing a crime, a serious crime. Tell me that that's not true. But again, because of his testimony, or lack thereof, the robber went scot-free. Isn't this almost exactly what happened with Scooter and Cheney and Rove and the rest of this band of political thieves, thugs, and outlaws? Isn't that exactly what happened? Do you find fault with that analogy somewhere? You'd better believe that there were a lot of drinks poured on the Washington cocktail circuit last evening because of this, and not because they were unhappy with Bush's immoral decision. Yeah, it's immoral, all right. This whole administration is nothing but pure filth and doesn't deserve to be in office another day. They never deserved to walk in to the people's house. Cheney never deserved to walk into the old executive office building as the vice president of the United States. If I knew that our country was going to have this kind of leadership for the rest of my life, I swear to God I would pack up everything I own tomorrow and I would move to another country. Thankfully, I don't feel that it'll be that way the rest of my life. But Bush and his people have made a mockery of our Constitution, of our laws. They've made a mockery of our ethical and our moral compass as a nation. They are the worst kind of people on this planet. They've committed crimes against all of humanity with a lot of their decisions, and they're no better than some of the tin-horn dictators that they profess to abhor. People that they preach against constantly, they're no better. They've had thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people slaughtered in the name of big oil, in the name of money, in the name of imperialism and power for themselves. They've had hundreds of thousands of people slaughtered. People from other countries and Americans. I wondered what I was going to say today, and I don't know what the rest of the show will bring because I'm so pissed off I can't see straight over this. One can only hope that the American people might take a look at this new crop of Republican presidential candidates and the Republican legislators who've so solidly backed this filthy bunch in the White House. And maybe have the courage and the moral values necessary to keep them out of office. You know, there's going to be a lot of people say, well, the Democrats are just as bad. You're going to hear that. My question is, could they be any worse? Could any administration be worse than this one? Could any administration do a better job of spitting in the face of the American public than these people have done? They've spied on us. They've lied to us. They've sent our boys and girls to a war that never should have been. They've okayed torture. They've invaded a sovereign nation. They've pissed off the entire world. I don't want anybody to look at me in this next election, no matter what party they're from, and say, well, you know, the Democrats are just as bad. No. As bad as they are right now, and as poor as the leadership is in the Democratic Party right now, by God, they could never be as bad as these people are now. Because as inept as Democrats could ever be, they'll never be as poorly intentioned as these people are now. I am sick to death of these people being in control. They flaunt it. And the American public, what do they do about this? I'll bet you $100 right now that more Americans know who Paris Hilton is than knows about Scooter Libby. I would bet you that. Hell, I'd bet more than that if I had it. I don't. But I'd bet it all in a poker game, that more Americans know who Paris Hilton is and what she's been up to than what Scooter Libby is and what he's done. I'd bet you that. I think it's a pretty safe bet. Set on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hi, Juanita.
You are so right, Guy. I thoroughly agree 100% with what you say. You're just so right on it. You're right on it.
Well,
And really nothing more I could add. I mean, you have said it, and you said it eloquently and truthfully.
Well, thank you. I hate the fact that they're getting away with this.
I know, but you know, we shouldn't be surprised.
No, I'm not. I'm not.
Really? You know, what else could we expect? But I've heard a lot of commentary on it, but I do believe that this is to keep him quiet.
Yeah. Yeah. This was more in a commutation for Scooter Libby. This, in my opinion, was also probably a pardon, if you will, for Karl Rove and Dick Cheney.
Oh, always.
Heading it off at the pass.
Always. But, you know, it just gets more and more and more disgusting. More sickening.
It sure does. It sure does every single day.
Yeah. You know, I think our Democrats need to study up on the 12-step program. I think it might help them to see what they're into. You know, I think that they go back to that, well, they can't be that bad or whatever. You know, maybe we can reason with them, but there's some people you just cannot reason with, and these people don't want to be reasonable.
No, certainly not. They do not. They just don't care. They just don't. They've got
at this point,
they've got nothing to lose.
No, that's right.
How can you threaten somebody that's got nothing to lose? You know.
Right. And you know, and my, God only knows what will happen between now and 2009, January 2009.
That's right.
While they're still in office, I mean. I don't know. We need to get them out of there some way, somehow.
Well, that's going to happen. I have no doubts about that. They will be turned out of office. The entire Republican claim
as
will
soon
be.
As possible. You think about how many people are being killed over our people being killed over in Iraq.
Right.
A year and a half to go. Monthly, 100. What is it? 100 people now.
Oh, yeah. It's averaging 100 a month easily.
It's just going to go up and up and up.
Sure.
And I don't think that the Democrats are thinking about that. You know, I think it's something, I don't know how you're going to get through to them, but.
Well, we've got to somehow convince them to.
Right.
Summon up some political courage somehow.
I heard a woman today call in, and she said, I would just love to go up to Bush and just slap him in the face and say, who do you think you are?
Exactly.
And you know what? Somebody's going to do something. They can't keep... You keep pushing people in a corner, something's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, they've certainly done enough pushing.
They sure have.
Thanks for your call. Good to hear
from you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Let's head on over here to line two. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Oh, hello, Guy. It's Teresa calling. I'm from Canada.
Hi, Teresa.
How are you?
Embarrassed. Embarrassed, ashamed.
Your government should be.
I'm apologetic to people from other countries.
Well, you shouldn't be personally, but I just can't believe this. And I also just saw on the CNN website that Bush isn't ruling out a pardon.
Yeah. Ruling nothing out and nothing in, he said.
Like, why didn't he just have the brass to just pardon him right away? You know, not that I would want that to happen. But, like, he, even with his buddies and that, no, he doesn't pardon him right away. He commutes the sentence so that the conviction still stands, so that there's still something hanging over Libby or whatever.
He's still going to do it.
So that they can still control him like a little puppet, and then, you know, at some point they'll...
You're absolutely right. They're going to do it in stages.
Mm-hmm.
And
he can plead the fifth.
Sure, and when they're on the way out the door, moving out of the White House, the day the new administration takes office, Scooter can say whatever he wants to at that point.
Yeah.
He won't, but he could.
Yeah. It's just disgusting.
It is.
I can't believe it. I will never say a bad word about Paris Hilton again. She served more time than Libby.
Yeah.
Like, how do you pardon someone? He wasn't pardoned. How do you commute a sentence for time served when there was no time served?
Right. Even their own Justice Department has said, former Justice Department officials said they always considered how much time had been served before they would do a commutation or recommendation for it. But Bush didn't even ask the DOJ about this.
I was going to say that. Apparently he didn't even contact them or anything.
But then the other question, it begs the question, do we even have a functioning Department of Justice right now? I'm not sure.
No, that's true. Yeah, well, what's the point in asking?
Yes.
Who cares what the answer is?
Right. Hey, thanks for your call. Good to hear from you.
Nice talking to you.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Yeah, first Paris Hilton and now Scooter Libby. Oh. Well, wait a minute. Paris Hilton actually had to spend some time in jail. What was it, 23 days for a traffic offense? 23 days for a traffic expense. Let's put this on the scales here for just for a moment. She 23 days in the jail for a traffic offense, and regardless of what you think about that, Scooter didn't even spend a minute in a pokey for lying to the FBI and to a federal grand jury and a federal prosecutor. You know, when you think about it that way, man, did Paris Hilton ever get screwed in that deal? Bad. And when you think of it in that light, in fact, didn't everyone who ever spent time in jail for obstruction of justice and perjury get screwed by this Junior Bush decision? Everybody. But like I mentioned before, let's be fair here. I think we all know who made the decision on this one, and it's the same guy who's evidently made almost all of the decisions during this disastrous period of time called the Bush administration. Cheney did this to keep the canary from singing. It's that simple. That simple. You can waste your time just like I did today, but I did it anyway, and I'm probably going to do it again, make you feel a little bit better. You can call the White House comments line to express your opinion on this. And I happen to have their number right here in case you haven't called. It's 202-456-1111. 202-456-1111. You can call and give them hell. I've been getting a lot of it today. Wouldn't you like to be a fly on the wall and hear all the comments they're getting today? What was it? Something like 72% of the people thought the Scooter Boy shouldn't get a pardon. Well, he didn't get a pardon exactly, but you wait. He will. They're going to do this in steps, just like our previous caller said. They're going to do it in steps. Never will I forget that statement of Bush that day. If there's a leak out of my administration, I want to know who it is. He was up in Chicago when he said it. If that person's violated the law, that person will be taken care of. Does anybody think for a moment, even a moment, that Scooter Libby's going to pay that $250,000 fine? Oh, it'll be paid. It'll be paid. Do you think Scooter's going to spend a nickel out of his pocket for it? Do you think Scooter's had to pay a nickel out of his pocket for the millions of dollars gone into his legal defense? Not a penny. Not a penny. And so he has this terrible punishment of losing his law license and losing his good name around Washington, D.C., and forever besmirching his name. Let me ask you, considering who Scooter Libby's circle of friends are and his business acquaintances, considering who they are, has he lost his ability to make a living in Washington, D.C., or amongst the cronies of the administration or the neocons? The answer is no, hell no. He's lost nothing. Will him losing his law license have any effect on his income for the rest of his life? Again, the answer is no, hell no. They will take care of this man for the rest of his life. He will live out his life. I don't know how old he is, late 50s, early 60s. He will live the rest of his life in comfort. And they will make sure of it. And oh, all the boo-hoo-hooing that took place within the Washington establishment, inside the Beltway, from the cocktail circuit, and from the neocons, from the Bill Kristols and all of those people. They must be a little happy today, but then again, a lot of them are pissed off that he didn't get a full pardon. But don't forget, he will get a pardon. Oh, yes, he will get a pardon. Well, I got to tell you, pretty unhappy over this. I know you are as well. You can give us a call, 866-546-5254. I got a couple of great guests coming up a little later on today, coming up around 4:15. We've got Eric Peterson, who edited the book out, Light and Liberty, The Reflections In the Pursuit of Happiness by Thomas Jefferson. Wonderful, wonderful small book. I had a chance to read it recently, and I am so, so glad that I did. And coming up after that, around 4:35 today, we've got Robert Boris. Robert is producing the new film, The USA versus Bush. It's the story of the Elizabeth de la Vega story. As you know, we've had Elizabeth on the program, and we'll have those coming up in the second hour of the program today. Let's hear a little bit from Joe Wilson, and then we'll go to a break.
Clearly short-circuited the system of justice and the rule of law in this country. But that said, now that he has done so, he no longer can hide behind the veil of not being able to answer questions so long as there is a process ongoing, since he has short-circuited that process. At a minimum, he ought to begin to level with the American people about what he knew, and more particularly about the actions taken by the vice president in this, to clear the air on what Mr. Fitzgerald has called a cloud over the office of the vice president. And he can begin doing so by instructing the special counsel to release all the documents related to this investigation, and particularly the interview that he and the vice president did with Mr. Fitzgerald.
So far, the White House has not been very eager to release documents, as you know, Joe. Valerie Plame, your wife, is she aware of what has happened here?
Yeah, first of all, her name is Valerie Wilson. She took me, Mr. Novak didn't even get that part of the story right. And yes, she most certainly is aware of it. I'm not surprised that the office of the president and the White House is not willing to come clean with the American people. I think this is a clear indication of just how utterly and totally corrupt this entire administration is, from top to bottom.
The Bush administration, some officials that we've spoken to, are painting this almost as a compromise here, saying that the president could have pardoned Scooter Libby, but rather he commuted the sentence, that this was not something as harsh as he could have carried out.
In actual fact, Mr. Libby was indicted by the U.S. government. He was judged in our system of justice by a jury of his peers. He was found guilty on four counts of perjury, lying, and obstruction of justice in a case that involved a direct subordinate of the President of the United States and of the Vice President of the United States. In my judgment, this so-called compromise, just prolongs that obstruction of justice and prohibits the special counsel from getting to the truth. And in fact, to the suggestion it's a compromise, in fact, what it is, it's the president bending to a neoconservative sect, doing a special pleading that the president has decided takes precedence over rule of law and the system of justice in this country. And I would remind people that this is a president who, as governor of Texas, refused to commute the first execution of a female prisoner even after the Pope pleaded for clemency.
Joe, now Congress can't do anything about this, commuting the sentence here, but obviously you and your wife, you still have a civil suit that's pending. What is next for you?
Well, I believe, first of all, I think Congress should open up an immediate investigation into whether or not the vice president and the president were themselves complicit in obstruction of justice in executing this commutation of a sentence. We have a civil suit pending. We will take this suit to the limits that justice will allow, and we believe in the system of justice in this country, and justice will be done.
Scooter Libby was not indicted, obviously, for leaking the identity of your wife, but for lying in that particular case. Do you have anything to say to him?
To Scooter Libby?
Yes.
I have nothing to say to any of these people. The fact that you know as well as I do, because you followed this case, there were lots of reasons why the underlying crime was not indicted on, not least of which because he lied, committed perjury, and obstructed justice. But I certainly don't owe this administration anything in terms of a comment. They certainly owe my family, and my wife in particular, an apology for having betrayed her, essentially committing treason. Scooter Libby is a traitor.
Ambassador Joe Wilson, thank you so much for joining us here at the Situation Room.
Better yet, do you feel it? That's what Night Sounds is all about, and I can't wait. I'm so ready. He's going to change the way we hear music.
Hey, you got the number, don't you? 866-546-5254. If you'd like to use your nickel and you've got minutes to spare, 941-876-6896. And if you happen to be in our nation's capital, you can call us in our Washington Bureau, 202-370-6153. Surely you have something to say about the events that happened along about this time yesterday afternoon. Surely you do, if you're a breathing human being, one way or another. And we invite our neocon friends to call in as well. Oh, wouldn't we love it? Yes, to hear how there was no underlying crime and this was a miscarriage of justice in the first place. I'd love to hear that again. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey there, Guy. As always, a most informative program.
Hi, Dave.
Dave from Eureka, yes. Two thoughts. One you're clearly explaining, but Mary Madeline, I think, headed it up, but the right-wing Wacko Talks Radio has been taking up a collection for Scooter Libby, the poor man, and last I heard they had about $9 or $10 million.
Fred Thompson, too.
Yeah. And so not only is he not going to have to pay his little fine, he can live comfortably the rest of his life. Probably he's been getting a good piece of the pie all along. The other thing is that nobody that's in tight in this administration could ever be allowed to go to prison because they're not the strong character types that'll say, I'll stand by my friend even if they're sacrificing me. When any one of them goes to prison, I think the whole story comes out. So they can't let that happen.
Well, now you're right. I wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah. I think, in effect, you've been saying that. Excellent show, as always, Guy.
Thank you, Dave. Good to hear from you.
Thanks, too.
And you can join in the conversation, 941-876-6896, or toll-free at 866-546-5254. Yeah, let's do take a look. I mentioned Fred Thompson. You know, the announcement that Junior Bush was going to commute the sentence of Cheney's former chief of staff, Scooter Libby. By the way, he's the highest-ranking White House official to be convicted of a crime since the Iran-Contra affair. And we all know what happened with Daddy Bush pardoning those people. Is Scooter the modern-day Ollie North? I don't know. Fred Thompson raised millions to defend convicted felon Scooter Libby. Thompson urged a pardon. Fred Thompson has helped to raise millions of dollars as a chair of now-convicted Scooter Libby's defense fund. He said he reached out to Libby and offered to help. I called him up and offered to help him, said Thompson. He strongly supported a pardon for Libby. Today, he said, I'm very happy for Scooter Libby. I know that this is a great relief to him, to his wife, his children. While for a long time I have urged a pardon for Scooter, I respect the president's decision. This will allow a good American, huh, Fred? A good American, a lying son of a bitch. I'm sorry if that's a bit strong, but I feel strongly about this. A good American, Fred, a good American. Are you a good American for saying that? To circumvent the jury system and the court system and the judges, Republican judges, I might add, that sentenced him according to federal prosecution guidelines. A good American who's done a lot for his country to resume his life. What has he done for this country besides be a traitor? That's what Scooter Libby is. He is a traitor to the United States of America, along with his pals Dick Cheney and Karl Rove. And in light of what's happened the last few days, I would add Mr. Bush to that list as well. Up till now, I thought he was just a dupe. He's more than that. He's complicit. Mitt Romney bragged about denying every commutation and pardon request while he was governor. They asked him if he would consider pardoning Scooter Libby. He said, well, it's worth looking at. I'll study it very closely, and if I'm lucky enough to be president, I'll keep that option open. Rudy Giuliani, Mr. Tough Guy Republican. He suggested a commutation. Always talking about how tough he was on it. I, Rudy Giuliani, I know all about terrorism, and I know all about crime. I've made New York City so safe you can walk in any of the streets in New York City at 4 a.m. with $1 million in cash on you, and you'll be perfectly safe. That's what Giuliani's been telling us. He said that Scooter Libby's sentence was grossly excessive, and that he would consider pardoning, saying a man's life is at stake, and that there was, quote, no underlying crime involved. Tough guy, Rudy Giuliani. John McCain. Now, well, let's ask John McCain what he thinks about it. He was asked about it, and he said, well, it's going through an appeal process. We're just going to have to see what happens. Well, it's happened, John. What do you think now? Somebody asked, one of you pundits have the guts, might I say the balls, to stand up to these people and ask them some tough questions? Let's go back to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, this is Brian in Tennessee. I didn't know I was on the air.
Hi, Brian, you are.
Okay, I don't mean to sound like I'm barking up the wrong tree here, but I think maybe we should defund the Democrats. Because, and I agree, I mean, maybe they can't be possibly as bad as this administration, but if they're not going to impeach, then they are complicit in these crimes.
Well, you know, I'm so clouded on this right now. I'm just as unhappy with the Democrats as you are.
Right, and I don't mean to sound like I'm getting angry at the wrong people, but, you know, if they solicit, you know, I can't afford to give, but a lot of people do donate to the Democratic Party. Ask them, where's the money going?
Yeah, well, it's going to get power, and they got some power with it, but the question being, what have they done with it? They've been browbeaten and beaten down to death. They've got nothing accomplished so far, this Democratic Congress. Nothing. And to be frank, I don't have any hopes for them getting anything done. Oh, they'll continue with these investigations, and Conley will have some more investigations, and Leahy will. They're not going to do anything. They're not going to do anything. Conley already's barking and say, oh, we're going to have investigations into this commutation and everything. Ah, oh, come on. I'm not saying they shouldn't have the investigations, but damn it, when they find out things like they found about Gonzalez and so forth, why have investigations if you're just going to throw the stuff in a paper bag and put it in a filed drawer someplace and never ask on it? You're exactly right.
What you were saying earlier about the, you know, the bank robbing analogy, I mean, yeah, there is an underlying crime here, and you know, I was on the Pigman's website just because I wanted to see how he would try to defend Bush and Libby on this. And he,
I'm glad you called and are telling me this, because frankly, I didn't have the courage to go over there today and find out. So fill me in.
He said there was no crime that we knew who originally leaked the idea, the identity of what's her name. He actually said what's her name. Her career was ruined, first of all. Plus, she was a spy, so being outed, her personal safety has been put in, and this king of the dung heap that is right-wing radio can only refer to her as what's her name.
Man, oh man, that's...
I mean, who is the real victim here, Libby or, well, not just Valerie Plame, all of us, because she was working for 20 years investigating WMD proliferation, so our national security has been compromised because of her being outed.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's treason involved in this. I don't think there's any doubt about it. They can talk all they want to about poor Scooter's life, What about it? What about the Wilsons and their lives? But you know, you're exactly right. Where's
Well, and yeah, he goes and he attacks her. You know, just the same way they do with Cindy Sheehan.
Yeah,
I mean,
and everybody's so concerned about poor Scooter Libby. Such a sentiment is made all the more callous when you consider that unlike Scooter, who knows full well what he was doing and when he lied to these investigators, the Wilsons didn't have a say in having their lives turned upside down. You know, where's Bush's statement saying how sorry he is that Wilson got a royal screwing in all this? Where's his apology to Joe and Valerie Wilson? Where's that apology? We're not hearing it.
Yeah.
It's a disgusting situation. You're in Tennessee?
Yeah.
Well, we're glad you called the program. Glad to know.
Yeah, I'm too pissed off to talk right now.
Me too, but I got to. Thanks for calling. Bye now. Yeah. Yeah, when are they going to come out and say anything about the Wilsons? When's Bush going to have the cojones to come before the American public and say, you know, I'm really sorry. I'm regretful that what's happened to the Wilsons has happened to them. I'm regretful that a good and faithful servant of the United States government in the CIA was outed by my administration, and I haven't done anything about it. When are we going to hear that? If he would come out and say something like that, at least part of this Scooter Libby thing might be a little bit palatable. But that's what I was talking about giving the American public the finger. I'm going to commute his sentence, and eventually I'm going to pardon him, and we all know that. But to the Wilsons, screw you. That's what it's all about. You know, if there's a lesson to be learned, I think it's this, and it's profound, if people can perceive it. You can't shame the shameless. You can't. And trying to convince such people that they shouldn't do wrong is a waste of time. And you can apply this lesson to the media, to the Republicans, to the authoritarians, to the corporatists. It's a long list these days. The important question then becomes, what are the good people to do now? What are the good people to do now? I'll leave it up to you to answer that question because I don't have an answer for it. I don't know where we go from here. You look at all the papers today. The New York Times castigating Bush for Libby's commutation. Presidents have the power to grant clemency and pardons, but in this case, Mr. Bush did not sound like a leader. Well, when the hell's he ever sounded like a leader? Didn't sound like a leader, says the New York Times, making tough decisions about justice. He sounded like a man worried about what a former loyalist might say when actually staring into a prison cell. Well, amen to that. He did, in fact, sound that way. This administration is corrupt. It is immoral. It has been unethical from the beginning. It has been totally irresponsible. Man, reminds you of that old song. What was the name of it? Everybody knows the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows that the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich, and that's how it goes. Everybody knows. Don't know why I remember that all of a sudden, but I do. And that old song, somebody sent me an email earlier today. Reminded me of that old song. I fought the law and the law won. Well, Scooter Libby fought the law. And the law lost. They certainly did. They lost. You know, the implications of what Bush has done here are huge. justice with his refusal, you might as well say, to get rid of Alberto Gonzalez. This partial pardon of Libby demonstrates to all of those loyal Bushies who remain ensconced in various agencies, it's telling them all that lying on behalf of the president won't be frowned upon, and those who do it will be protected from accountability. And everybody was worrying about the underlying crime. And this is a man who suddenly hates excessive punishments. This is a man who once refused to commute the death sentence of a 33-year-old mentally retarded black man with the IQ of around 60 and the functional skills of a 7-year-old boy. This is a man who refused to commute that sentence. Had a record of 152 executions during 2 terms as governor. There never has been a more bloodthirsty governor in the United States. And he wrote in his autobiography, "I don't believe my role is to replace the verdict of it." These are Bush's words. "I don't believe my role is to replace the verdict of a jury with my own." You know, somewhere there's a tipping point for this Bush administration. I keep thinking we're about there. In my mind, I think that Bush's commutations of Libby's sentence yesterday just might be it. And I may not be capable of providing an extended rationale for that kind of thinking, but I've learned to trust my gut, and in any case, we'll see, won't we? We'll see. But I think probably the most important part of all this is that I think what I said earlier is true. More people cared about Paris Hilton going to jail. More people know who Paris Hilton is, and what's that other girl, that friend of hers? I don't know. Lindsay something, Lohan. More people know about their trials and tribulations, if you will, than know about Scooter Libby. And isn't that a shame? Isn't that just a shame? We have all these stories on TV. The Anna Nicole Smith, all these stories, and America seems to give a damn about things like that, but something that comes up that genuinely affects the lives of all of us. Oh, how does this affect all of us, guy? How does this politician getting the commutation, not having to go to jail, how does this affect us, guy? Well, like I just mentioned a moment ago, we've got a corrupt administration in power. There's thousands of people working in this Bush administration, and so the rest of them decide they want to lie, cheat, and steal. They know damn well they're not going to jail, don't they? They know if they're linked closely enough to the president, they're not going anywhere, or in this case, the vice president. And I'd like to know, what did Cheney threaten to do if Bush didn't take action on Libby, huh? I'd like to hear the little talk that they had. And did this commutation bring Scooter's eternal silence? Silence about what exactly? You know, there's going to be a lot of interesting questions that'll remain unanswered forever and ever with this commutation and the eventual pardon he's going to get. And we do know that because of Libby's crimes, we're never going to get the whole story, the whole truth, about one of the ugliest little episodes in U.S. history. And that's the false pretense for the invasion and the occupation of Iraq and the attempt to discredit a man who exposed that in one Ambassador Joe Wilson. You know, there's people talking about Congress maybe having to do something about it. We know that Congress probably should find a way to restrict and permanently restrict the executive branch's ability to grant clemency. They really should. It's been abused. Clinton abused it. It's not going to be easy. This Libby precedent that was set yesterday is going to make the pardon process not much more than a get-out-of-jail-free card for any rogue willing to commit crimes involving war or national security. And they know that if they're discovered and if they're convicted, they'll do less time behind bars than Paris Hilton. You know, we just had the Department of Justice coming out not too long ago wanting to increase these guidelines, sentencing guidelines. And I looked this up today in Section 1-2-113, Standards for Considering Commutation Petitions. This is from our own Department of Justice. It says a commutation of sentence reduces the period of incarceration. Get that. Reduces the period of incarceration. It does not imply forgiveness of the underlying offense, but simply remits a portion of the punishment. It has no effect upon the underlying conviction and does not necessarily reflect upon the fairness of the sentence originally imposed. Oh, really? Does not necessarily reflect upon the fairness of the sentence originally imposed. We have the President of the United States issuing a commutation saying the sentence was excessive. And the Department of Justice further says, requests for commutation generally are not accepted unless and until a person has begun serving that sentence, nor are commutation requests generally accepted from persons who are presently challenging their convictions or sentences through appeal or other court proceedings. You know, Bush didn't just reduce Libby's jail sentence, he eliminated it. And his reasoning was that the judge's sentence was excessive. He went totally against everything our Department of Justice had to say about this. Question. Is Junior Bush arguing that people who commit perjury and obstruct justice should not go to jail? Or maybe only the right kind of people should go to jail, huh? Maybe someone should ask Tony Snow, and they did a little bit today, and we'll have a little bit of that for you early in the second hour. One way to look at it, either way, this was a great, great last couple of days for defense attorneys all the way across the United States. Is that a fact? Man, you got a client on trial right now for perjury or obstruction of justice. You'd be a fool to leave that lie, wouldn't you? Yeah. And I think now that Scooter's a free man, I think the next step's pretty obvious. He should be called to testify on these on this plethora of scandals that he was intimately involved in. And technically, I heard John Dean say, well, he can invoke the Fifth Amendment, but either Fitzgerald or Congress can grant him immunity. He's not going to jail anyway. And have him testify about what Cheney's done, especially with regard to Valerie Plame. And the question becomes then, would Bush invoke executive privilege? Will Libby lie under oath? If you got immunity, you still can't lie under oath. And he could get his ass again. Of course, so what? There's a lot of questions to ask here. Many, many, many questions. And we hope you'll be asking them. We're going to pause for news at the top of the hour, coming up in about 1 minute or so. Just as an aside here, did any of you get one of the new iPhones? What a debacle that turned out to be for a lot of folks. Stood in line to buy them for hours, took them home, only to find out that AT&T screwed up and they can't activate some of them right now. Oh, I'd be hot about that. I've heard horror stories about people being on the phone, not the iPhone, of course, but being on the phone for hours trying to talk to someone in the tech department at AT&T. That's always fun, isn't it? Hello, my name is Charles. Where are you at, Charles? I'm in Bombay. Oh, yeah. Hey, we're going to pause for news coming up at the top of the hour. We hope you'll stay with us. We've got a lot to talk about. Hope you have a lot to talk about. Back in a minute here on the Guy James Show.
This is the Quality News Network. A total of 8 suspects have now been detained in connection with the failed terror attacks in London and Glasgow, including a doctor in Australia. Sources say 2 suspects of the Glasgow attack are doctors and were recruited out of Liverpool. After commuting the 30-month prison sentence late yesterday of Vice Presidential aide Louis Scooter Libby, the furor over the reduced sentence continued during a White House press briefing today. When asked by reporters if the president will grant a pardon, Press Secretary Tony Snow declined to say anything definitively. Libby will still have to pay a $250,000 fine and serve a 2-year probation. A Denver hospital treating the Atlanta lawyer who traveled with a drug-resistant form of tuberculosis is set to announce that Andrew Speaker has been diagnosed with a more treatable form of TB than previously thought. Doctors say Speaker's TB is still resistant to some drugs but can be treated with antibiotics. In Pakistan, at least 8 people have been killed and 120 injured during a violent standoff between Pakistani security forces and armed students wanting Islamic Sharia law. Militant students from an Al-Qaeda-linked mosque have been engaged in kidnappings and threatening suicide bombings during their campaign to impose strict religious law in the capital city. London's Heathrow Airport Terminal 4 was evacuated today as security inspects a suspicious bag. Authorities are keeping the threat level across Britain at critical. Millions of holiday travelers can expect increased security during Independence Day week because of the attempted terrorist attacks in the UK. More than 41 million Americans will travel more than 50 miles from their home this week, a new record for Independence Day travel. An estimated 4.7 million will fly in and out of U.S. airports. U.S. military forces killed at least 23 insurgents suspected of having links with al-Qaeda during a fierce battle in Iraq's western Anbar province. According to U.S. military sources, insurgents there were attempting to reestablish a base of operations using large-scale suicide bomb attacks. A U.S. helicopter was shot down by insurgents near Baghdad late yesterday. The 2 pilots were rescued and escaped with only minor injuries. Japan's defense minister resigned today after making remarks that appear to accept the 1945 atomic bomb attacks on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. His replacement will be a woman and the first in Japan to hold the office. Russian President Vladimir Putin offered an alternative to President Bush regarding a planned U.S. anti-missile shield. Putin wants to set it up in southern Russia, a plan the president will likely reject. This is QNN.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
Now, NASA space shuttle Endeavour is one step closer to an August launch date. Endeavour moved from its hangar at the Kennedy Space Center to the Vehicle Assembly Building, where it will be outfitted with its external fuel tank and solid rocket boosters. Then it's on to the nearby launch pad by next Monday. Pickups, SUVs, and vans all fell short on rear-end crash testing. More than half of the 87 light trucks tested by U.S. insurance industry analysts fell short of optimum safety. Results for the 2004 through 2007 models were mixed overall. Boeing is getting ready to unveil its newest passenger jet in 13 years. The 787 Dreamliner is the world's first commercial jet made primarily of plastic. It debuts on the ground on July 13th. Boeing hopes to have six 787s in test flights by the end of the year. Commercial service starts in May of 2008. Apple Incorporated sold 525,000 iPhones since the June 29th launch. Half of the Apple stores on the West Coast sold out on the first day. About 2% of buyers have experienced extended delays in activating their service, according to AT&T. The former CEO of 7-Eleven stores will become the newest head of movie rental company Blockbuster. 52-year-old James Keyes replaces John Antioco, who was leaving after nearly a decade with the company. Light sweet crude is trading at $71.76 a barrel right now, and on Wall Street, the Dow Jones is up 42 points, the NASDAQ is up 13, and the S&P 500 is up 5 points. You can always log on and find more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Jay Gallet.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said.
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, back with you with more truth today. A slightly hot under the collar Guy James here with you today. I'm trying to smile. I'm trying to look at the bright side of the situation, if there is such a thing. They say every cloud has a silver lining. I'll be damned. I've looked all around this cloud that is a Bush administration, and I cannot find a silver lining in it anywhere. Can you? It's been 6 years of pure hell. It's been 6 years of embarrassment and shame for our country. That's what it's been. And now we hear through the press that Bushy boy himself isn't worried a bit about it. No, he's sleeping good at night. He's thinking that history is going to vindicate him, that 100 years from now he'll be looked upon as a man who brought peace to the Middle East and done a great job as being president of the United States. Why, hell, he'll be another Abraham Lincoln, right? Yeah. Hey, coming up in just a little bit, we're going to have Eric Peterson on, who put together this great book, Reflections of the Pursuit of Happiness by Thomas Jefferson. And I'll let him explain it all to you. He's going to be coming up at about a quarter past the hour, so we've got a few minutes to talk about Scooter yet. And I was thinking today there's a curve going on here in this country, and I don't know if we're in the last throes. Do you think this is like the end of the Roman Empire? Are we into that right now? It would appear that we are. I hate to say it that way, but it kind of appears that we are. But, you know, you start back in, 1787, the Bill of Rights and all that. Everybody's equal under the law except the blacks, who were only, 3/5 equal. And then along comes the Civil War and, you know, scratch that, they're all equal now. Everybody's equal. And in 64, we came along and said, you know, the Great Society, okay, we're serious this time. Everybody's equal. And here we are in 2007, and everybody's equal except prominent Republican white guys who seem to be helping us kill non-white people. That's how it is. Amazing story. It really is. And by the way, I did want to mention, I heard GOP strategist Ed Rollins say earlier, and I think I quoted him right, he said, "It's always hard to see a man like this go to jail." Well, I suppose it is, if you're one of them. You know, it's so true. He's not one of them, you know. He's not one of those nasty people. He just pulled off a little treason, that's all. I mean, come on. I just saw the, what I call the Fox All-Stars, practically pole dancing over this, saying outright that Libby's pals are going to pay his fines for him and that they'll have no problem finding work. And, you know, high fives from everybody. They got so excited they forgot they were supposed to be all somber over this horrible, awful punishment that poor little Scooter is going to have to endure, even though he's not going to spend a day in jail now. And despicable man that he is, Joe DiGenova on CNN, you know, Victoria Tensing's husband, that dynamic couple. Whew, what a couple of screwballs they are. You talk about neocon right wing, hard, oh, God. He spent what it seemed like a half hour saying over and over again that Libby was a great American and the next step is an investigation into prosecutorial misconduct by Patrick Fitzgerald. And he hopes that more will come out during the appeal. He said Patrick Fitzgerald's about to see his career permanently destroyed. It's a very depressing day. Even though we knew this was going to happen one way or another, it's just a continuation of this administration's utter disregard for the law and their belief that they're somehow, and believe me, they do believe that they are entitled to special treatment because they're just special. That's all. Bush has just slapped a jury and four Republican judges and the American people right in the face. And for all intents and purposes, has instigated a cover-up of his illegal acts by giving Scooter this amnesty. And it just keeps going. It just keeps going and going and going. It's the gift that keeps on giving to these modern-day neocons. We're going to pause for a quick break. And we'll be right back, and we'll have our guest on the phone, hopefully, at that time. So stay with us.
In the eye of the storm, to a new and a shiny place. Make our bed and we'll say our grace. Freedom's light burning warm. Freedom's light burning warm. Everywhere around the world, they come to America. Every time that flag's unfurled, they come to America. Got a dream to take them there. They come to America. Got a dream they come to share. They come to America.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon. Kind of a stormy day here where we are in Southwest Florida. I hope wherever you are all around the world that it's a nice day. It's kind of a stormy political day here in this country. That's a fact. But we've discussed that, and we'll discuss it some more a little later on in the program. But right now, as promised, I have with us our guest today. We have Eric Peterson, and he put together this great, great book called Light and Liberty, The Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. And Eric, welcome to the Guy James Show.
Thank you. Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure, and I thank you for having me on your show.
Well, you are to be congratulated on this book. It's something that should be required reading for everybody, I think. I don't think a lot of people have the appreciation for Thomas Jefferson that they really should. And by the way, if I remember right, tomorrow is the anniversary of his death.
Absolutely. The 50 years to the day after Congress approved his Declaration of Independence.
It was him and Adams both died. It wasn't within a few hours of each other?
Yes, and it's seen as a quite an interesting coincidence, almost a divine coincidence by people at the time, that both of the great patriots of the country would die in the exact same day, 50 years after the approval of the Declaration of Independence.
And fill me in. They did not, and toward the end of their lives, they had a great warm relationship, but it wasn't always so, was it?
It wasn't. They were friends earlier in their career. John Adams was one of the ones who urged that Thomas Jefferson be appointed to write the Declaration. And they served together in Europe as ministers to France and England in the 1780s. But they were on opposite sides of the political fence because in the 1790s, John Adams was associated with the Federalist Party, the party of Alexander Hamilton, the party that Thomas Jefferson thought was a little too elitist-oriented. But toward the end of their years, they became friends again, and a lot of the material in this book, Light and Liberty, is drawn, in fact, from the correspondence between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams.
Wow, they had a warm and wonderful writing relationship during the last few years of their lives, and quite a bit. You know, I mentioned to you before we went on today that I read this book up and back on a trip to Washington recently. And was just enthralled with it, and I didn't realize, having looked at the promotional material from your publisher, you've gotten some pretty good references here: Mikhail Gorbachev, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Jason McManus, Willard Randall, quite a list of people that have, and even one of my arch nemesis, I might say, Newt Gingrich, but a smart man. Quite some glowing remarks about this book of yours.
Well, it was very nice to receive those comments. And what I think it is that Thomas Jefferson's vision really is at the heart of what we all love about our country. And also, I think it's the one thing about America that people around the world truly appreciate about this country. It's Thomas Jefferson's authentic vision. It's the vision of the kind of people that we in our hearts really aspire to be. I call it a vision of freedom and oneness, or you might say light and liberty, which was the title that we chose for the book. Thomas Jefferson was a great champion of of liberty, the rights of man, the pursuit of happiness, and those virtues associated with liberty. But he was also a great champion of oneness, you might say, identification with your fellow man, faith in the average citizen, belief in universal harmony and an ever brighter future, a very great optimist. And these are the principles and values of freedom and oneness that have touched so many people. I was very surprised and pleased that we were able to get comments from figures, great leaders like Mikhail Gorbachev and Archbishop Tutu. Archbishop Tutu said that Thomas Jefferson's wisdom in light and liberty has the power to capture the imagination and inspire those of us in the present-day world to, again, dream great dreams and do good deeds.
Well, I heartily agree, because greatness transcends national boundaries, has nothing to do with national boundaries. Greatness is recognized by all civilized people around the world, and certainly the greatness of Thomas Jefferson. He's a man amongst men, and probably, in my opinion, and has been for a long, long time, perhaps our greatest American. A man so very intelligent, but moreover, besides his intelligence and his education and all, he just had a wisdom that was so profound, and he was able to express it so well. Is the thing that's impressive about him?
He wrote what I call poetic prose. And he expressed what I feel to be ennobling thought. He really cared about the condition of his fellow man. And he lived and he served and he wrote not just for people in America, but for everyone in the world. He wrote that we are all members of the universal society of mankind. And he said that every person has an interest in the peace, prosperity, and happiness of every other person. And, of course, he was not limiting those comments to just to America, but to people all around the world. He was a great thinker on how we can organize our society in countries around the world to improve the lot of mankind, to better the condition of our fellow man.
I think the great surprise to a lot of people when they read this, Light and Liberty, is going to be the great diversity in his life. A lot of people think that he was just a politician, and he went far above just being a politician, like you just mentioned. The chapters in there on goodness and nature's beauty and being true to yourself. And one of the things that struck me, although this man had a self-awareness, certainly, of his intellect, He did it. He seemed to write in such a humble manner, in my opinion. Do you agree with that?
Very much so. One time he wrote, "If I can state with honesty of being conscious of anything, it is that I feel no difference between writing to the highest or the lowest being on earth." He would receive letters from the great statesmen and business people of his age. He would also receive letters from complete strangers. And he said he could never refuse to answer them. And they would ask him questions about all sorts of things, because he had a very great degree of interest in different subjects, ranging from architecture to botany to the mechanical arts to chemistry, philosophy, history, law. He was a great curiosity and a great deal of interest in everything in life. He wrote that there is not a sprig of grass that shoots uninteresting to me, nor anything that moves. A great deal of curiosity. So he corresponded with people, but he had this sense of humility. And I feel that you've put your finger on something very important. If I had to pick a quality that most expresses the ideal of all men are created equal, which is his phrase advocating an egalitarian outlook on life in the Declaration of Independence, it would be humility, because humility is a sense of feeling that no one in their deepest essence is really superior or inferior to anyone else. We all have different characteristics, personalities, talents, accomplishments, and so forth. But in our very essence, no one is either superior or inferior. And that is the idea behind all men are created equal. And Thomas Jefferson was, of course, the one who consolidated the victory of the American Revolution, which was not just about independence. You know, tomorrow we celebrate the 231st anniversary of our nation's independence from Great Britain. But it was also about equality. All men are created equal, the egalitarian, the great egalitarian principle that has that ideal has created the great American middle class, unrivaled anywhere in the world, and it springs from that principle of egalitarianism, respect for your fellow man, identifying with his concerns and aspirations, and feeling that, in essence, we're all in this together and we should all be supportive of one another.
And he lived that. There's no question that he lived it. He wasn't one of these people that said, you know, do as I say, not as I do. He actually lived it in mind, spirit, and body. I mean, he even in this book got a little chapter on fitness. You've got into cheerfulness called Sweeten the Temper, which is a touching chapter, I think. Not thirsting for gain, about how people ought not be greedy. And why did you get so interested in this, and what portion of your life have you devoted to Thomas Jefferson research?
Well, I had the chance to visit Monticello a number of times. His home, his beautiful home, well worth a visit for any of your listeners who may not have had a chance to go there yet. It's a classical, elegant, simple, inspiring architecture, a beautiful view from the Blue Ridge Mountains. And he really had an elevated perspective on life and the possibilities of life that he manifested in his thought, his writings, and his actions, just as he manifested it in the creation of the architecture of his home in Monticello and also the architecture that he designed for the University of Virginia. And I decided that it was really worth exploring into the philosophy and the life and the accomplishments and the vision of a person who contributed so much to the founding of our country and the principles that we hold dear. And so I had the chance to read through all of his writings, and he wrote some 20,000 letters, and he saved copies of them all. Because he was so involved in public affairs, he wrote a number of laws, biographical sketches, even travelogues, replies to addresses of Indian chiefs. I mean, he was very involved in our society, a very active participant during his 83-year lifetime. And when you have a chance to get into his philosophy and into his life, he said his letters were the journal of his life. And so you can read through them all and see how his thought and his ideas and his contributions evolved. And I said to myself after reading through it all, boy, wouldn't this be great if people in today's era could have a sense of the essence of this great man's, this good man's philosophy. And so I selected perhaps 1,000 or 1,500 quotes, you know, small expressions, perhaps a sentence or two, no more than a paragraph, that I thought really captured his wisdom. And because he is our country's great philosopher of happiness, his phrase, pursuit of happiness, that is his phrase in the Declaration of Independence, I wanted to organize them in the way that would do justice to his philosophy. And he felt that, as he put it, happiness is the aim of life, and that virtue, this is a very Greek notion, virtue is the foundation of happiness. And then he added another thought, utility is the test of virtue. So in other words, he's saying if something is to be, something is virtuous if it tends to produce happiness on a practical basis. And so some of the chapter headings that you indicated, seeing the good in others, dreaming the impossible, doing what is right, patriotism, liberty, I selected 34 virtues and good qualities under which to organize his philosophy and his wisdom and try to make it easily available for people today. My publisher at Random House says that Light and Liberty is the book that Thomas Jefferson never wrote, although every word is his.
Oh, that's a great way of saying it. Let me give our listeners a brief. I want to give you a paragraph here. Under the chapter of aspirations, practice the purest virtue. Our greatest happiness does not depend on the condition of life in which chance has placed us, but is always the result of a good conscience, good health, occupation, and freedom in all just pursuits. The precept is wise, which directs us to try all things and hold fast that which is good. Nothing is troublesome that we do willingly. Endeavors to improve our situation, we should never despair. Be not weary of doing well. Let the eye of vigilance never be closed. Become an honest and useful man to those among whom we live. And above all things, be good. Because without that, we can neither be valued by others nor set any value upon ourselves. That last sentence in that is so, so beautiful and so profound.
He really was a wise man and a good man. And he expressed it in his personal life as well as in the life of public service. And I'm so appreciative that you read that particular paragraph, because you're really talking there about the aspiration to better ourselves, to be self-giving, to serve others, and to use the capacities that we've been given to build up ourselves, to enlarge our capabilities, if you will, so that we'd be happier citizens in the progress of improving ourselves and improving our country. The passage that you read is comprised of, I'm thinking, four or five different segments that I pieced together as I did all these chapters from different writings. It was a very interesting exercise because his thought was so profound, so consistent, and so insightful and so eloquently expressed that you can take a sentence or two from a letter in, you know, 1782 and another one from 1818 and piece it together and form a paragraph of consistent thought on a particular topic. That was what was so delightful about the project.
Well, I found several parts of the book that are particularly endearing to me, but that last sentence, that above all things, be good, because without that, we can neither be valued by others nor set any value on ourselves. I think that's something to live by for every human being on this planet.
And what's so interesting is his philosophy is really for all people of all ages. That particular sentence that you just read, I believe, was taken from a letter that he wrote to one of his daughters when she was in her teenage years. And there's other material in this book that's taken from soaring language in other letters or legislation, laws that he wrote, even to the exact opposite side of the spectrum. But that's a very personal observation he made in that letter. And yet it can be held right up against some language from a law or a lofty philosophical letter that he wrote to one of his well-known contemporaries. And his thought is so seamlessly eloquent and insightful that it kind of all blends together in a very uplifting philosophy of life.
Well, I wish I had the context of all of these like you do. I should be lucky enough to spend the rest of my life studying it and not come up with the editing that you've done on this. It's an amazing job. It really is. It's Random House, right? And the book's available just about everywhere now?
Yes, it is. It's published by Random House, the Modern Library Division, the one that does the classics, if you will, the well-received thoughts of our great writers and thinkers. We have a website for the book, if I might mention.
Yes, please.
It's the name of the book, lightandliberty.org. And this book is available. It is in bookstores. It's in places like the Jefferson Memorial, Monticello, and so forth, as well as in the online outlets like Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
And I also want to mention, Eric mentioned that this passage that I read was a letter to his daughter, Thomas Jefferson's daughter. This would be a wonderful book for any young person, especially someone heading into college or even a later high school student that could grasp the knowledge and the wisdom in this book. This is a book to live by. And I so appreciate the editing job you've done on this. It's a book that touched me deeply. It really did.
Very, very kind of you to say that. You know, we have had a number of inquiries from schools who are, you know, looking for good, solid, aspiring material to present to students who, as Jefferson would say, think for yourself. You know, form your own life philosophy, but who are looking for a good, practical, viable, positive life philosophies to live by. We've worked with some schools, have ordered quite a number of copies to be given to various students as the students, particularly in those formative years, are beginning the process of forming their own personal inner life philosophy. And Jefferson's wisdom is certainly, it can be very, very valuable and interesting, even as gifts, particularly to youngsters at that age as they're thinking about their future and deciding what kind of citizens they want to be.
I got about a minute left, and I've got to ask you a tough question. You can answer it if you want, if you can. Are there any Thomas Jeffersons alive today that you know of?
And I've been asked that question occasionally, and oftentimes the presumption is that the person would be an American.
No,
I would say that the person that comes closest to Thomas Jefferson in my mind is one of the ones that you mentioned earlier, Mikhail Gorbachev. Mikhail Gorbachev, the great leader who liberated hundreds of millions of people in Eastern Europe from the yoke of communist tyranny, who freed the world from the threat of massive nuclear annihilation, and who even today is still a great champion of Jeffersonian-type ideals. I learned that he studied Thomas Jefferson early in his college career in the 1950s. I was quite surprised to learn that.
Mm.
He gave us a very nice comment on the book. He said
he
that the lessons of Thomas Jefferson can be very valuable to us today as we're learning to live together in harmony and strengthen relations with one another around the world.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. I wish we had longer. We could talk for hours about this. Perhaps we can get you on again in the near future. A fabulous job you've done on this. Again, it's Light and Liberty, Reflections of the Pursuit of Happiness, Thomas Jefferson. And again, it's available at Random House and lightandliberty.org, right?
Lightandliberty.org. And Guy, I would like to thank you very much for doing this interview, and I appreciate your kind words for Light and Liberty.
Thank you so much. Well, we're going to pause for a quick break, and we'll be back in just a minute with our second guest today. Don't go away. Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Here we are about 22 minutes before the hour, and as promised, I have veteran filmmaker Robert Boris with us right now. We've spoken about this, his new film out, U.S. v. Bush, and I think his film is about to get an addition to it coming out this summer in light of the activities of the past couple of days. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hi, Guy. Thank you. It's great to be here, especially on this very austere occasion, I think, something that really takes us all to the core.
Am I wrong? Do you still have time to include this in the movie?
We haven't started filming it. The film isn't done. We're just in the process of casting right now. I don't know. I know you know Elizabeth de la Vega, and so I'm just about to cast the part of Liz Devlin, who is the prosecutor in the book, who U.S. v. Bush. And she's the one that wants to bring charges against Bush, Rice, Cheney, Colin Powell, and Donald Rumsfeld. And so right now we're in the process of casting. But I was really pleased. Oh, that's a terrible word to say, pleased about this. But I was fascinated by what happened and the fact that this administration is constantly flaunting the law and it seems to be so out of control, as if the rule of law does not apply to them. And I felt that there was a great way, and I felt very important to add some of this into the movie. So I do have time to get this into the movie now.
Well, I don't want to, and I hadn't planned on doing anything self-serving here, but as long as you're casting, I could do a really good Dick Cheney.
I would love to see your resume and your headshots, and we'll talk about casting you in the part. I'm looking for unknowns, because for people who are going to be playing the part of Cheney and Rice and Rumsfeld, I'm going to keep everybody in the movie. I'm going to use clips for most of the movie and use real news clips as the case is referred to, things that people say. But when we talk about Cheney, I think you might be a terrific choice.
Well, I've done theater for a number of years, and I always liked playing the heavy. And
you picked the Darth Vader of modern times.
I can't think of a worse heavy to portray, or a better one, as it were, for acting. How did you get involved in this with this project?
Well, I happen to like writing about politics, and I've been writing movies for a number of years, about 30 years, and so I've been doing a lot of different movies and directing a few. And way back about 20 years ago, I wrote a miniseries, a book and a miniseries called Blood Feud, about the struggle between Bobby Kennedy and Jimmy Hoffa. And it actually starred a kind of notorious guy right now. His name was Robert Blake, and he played Jimmy Hoffa. And he, in fact, was nominated for an Emmy, and so was I in the film and in the miniseries. And it was quite successful. And the great joy I had about doing that movie was that I got to do a ton of research in Washington and meet the people and the players of the times. It was fascinating to me. And so I always kind of watched the political scene, what's going on, and I came across this book. I think I saw it on a couple of websites or blog, Elizabeth de la Vega's blog, and then I found her book in it, which is fascinating to me. And I thought, the thing that got to me was that we have lost the art of political theater here in America. I kind of grew up on that, and when I was in the protest generation of the 70s and the 60s and all that stuff, political theater played a big part of what we did, We saw plays like McBird or other plays that really took on on various administrations and dealt with political issues. But I don't see a lot of that today. Maybe there's fear in this country. Maybe we're afraid to...
Yeah, ask the Dixie Chicks about the fear.
That's exactly right, and to me, that's what this country is all about. It's about being able to say whatever you want to say and be able to talk about whatever you wanted to talk about. And so I missed the great American tradition of political theater. And when I saw Elizabeth's book, I thought this was a classic piece, hypothetical. It's fantasy, it's political theater, but what a great chance to do something which is something America will never get, which is closure with this administration, or answers. And Elizabeth does a powerful job of getting those answers and getting that closure. And I thought, let's put it on screen.
How long is it going to take you to cast and film this?
Well, my guess to cast...
assuming that you've already got the Cheney spot filled. Assuming the rest of it.
I've left it open just for you guys.
All right, thank you.
At the moment, the casting of it, I would think it takes about probably a month to, 6 weeks maybe, maybe 2 months tops to do the casting. The shooting of it itself will be done in under a month because it's basically one location. As you know, if you've seen the book and read the book, it is basically a courtroom drama, and so Liz Devlin is the character in the book who presents this case before a grand jury in which she is attempting to get a grand jury to indict George Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Donald Rumsfeld for violation of Title 18, which is conspiracy to defraud the American people into war. So what Elizabeth de la Vega has done is quite cleverly and brilliantly provided all the testimony, which and the speeches and so forth, the opening statements that the prosecutor makes, because she's been doing this for 25 years. She's an experienced, established, and very successful federal prosecutor. So she presents all her testimony. She provides the testimony for the witnesses because she knows what, if she put together a task force, the kind of information she'd be getting from witnesses that she brings. And how a grand jury works is that the 23 grand jurors are allowed to ask questions of both the prosecutor and of the witnesses. So we have a wonderful cross-section of the American public as the grand jury asking a lot of questions, raising a lot of questions. And what I loved about it and what I tried to do in the script for the movie along with Elizabeth is to let that jury be a cross-section of the American people. It's not just people who have an axe to grind with the Bush administration. There are defenders. There are other people. It's a cross-section of the public. So we have grand jurors who take all sides of the issue and allows us not to be just a movie that's considered a Bush-bashing movie. It goes way beyond that. It tries to really deal with the issue.
Well, right. If you had a jury of 12 good men and women, right now, you'd have to have, and you had a cross-section, three of them would have to be people who supported George Bush.
That's absolutely right. I think that's the fair and right thing to do, and that's what I'm trying to do in this movie, is the fair and right thing to do. I want all sides to express their opinions. I want all sides to express their feelings. And if the case that Elizabeth has presented and we presented on film is strong enough, then it will be persuasive to anyone. I don't care what walk of life you're in, and I don't care what side of the aisle you root for. I think the case is so persuasive that everything that this country is about has been undermined by this administration, that I think it's a wonderful chance to do something in terms of a film that speaks to these issues and lets everybody have a voice in it.
Well, Robert, go ahead.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but in fact, we have a website called usvbushmovie.com, and everybody's welcome to come to it. And what I have tried to say to a couple of places where I've been speaking, I invite people from all walks of life and all of your listeners and your wonderful audience, invite them to send a question to the website so that I can put it in the mouths of one of the grand jurors and let them ask a witness or let them ask Elizabeth, Liz Devlin, a question, because I'd love to get questions from different people that they would have for this administration. So if you have a great question the administration, send it to my website, and I would be glad to have one of our grand jurors, ask that question of one of our witnesses.
It's usvbushmovie.com. usvbushmovie.com. Okay.
That's it. You got the whole thing.
Yeah, I hope people do that. I was had a conversation in person with Robert Greenwald recently, and I don't know if you know Robert, but
I know him quite well.
We were discussing intimidation, fear, heat, whatever. Perhaps that's why we haven't had more work like what you're doing and what Robert has been doing recently. Do you think that plays a part in any of this?
Guy, you're absolutely on the money. Let me tell you something really interesting that both fascinated me and frightened me. It really was chilling to me. I went... But when we put up the website, and if people go to the website, you'll see that we also have video blogs. I've invited people to send in their video and whatever comments they want to make about the issues and all of that stuff. We took a camera crew and went to Santa Monica to the Malibu area, the beach area, the Los Angeles streets, all kinds of different sections of Southern California. And I took a camera, and you'll see some of the interviews that are there on the website. I took a camera crew and said, you know, if the Bush administration was accused of these high crimes, do you think they should stand trial? A very simple question. I mean, it's not exactly, you know, a mind-shattering question. If they were accused, should they stand trial or should they not stand trial? And I got, I mean, we walked around with the camera crew, and I got dozens and dozens of people real curious when the camera's around and people are shooting footage. They come up and ask you about it, and then once they heard what the question was, they said, yeah, they should stand trial. They should be accused. They should face justice like everybody else. And I said, great, will you put that statement on camera? And almost like 90% said no.
Oh.
They were terrified. I said, even if we don't use your name, would you do it that way? Well, I won't put your name on the website. We'll just put your image up there. What are they going to do, find you on the basis of your image? People were afraid to speak. They fear retribution, recrimination from this government. And I look, I went through the protest generation of the 60s and 70s, and we went through an awful lot, but still people were willing to talk up, willing to speak. They, you know, they weren't afraid of their government. And there's an amazing streak in this country where people are afraid to challenge or afraid to be branded as being unpatriotic.
Man, I have to tell you, I'm experiencing an emotion like I seldom do in this program. I had goosebumps as you're telling me that about people saying no, they didn't want that on film or didn't want their... appalling.
It's appalling to me. It's not what this country is all about. It's not what we've fought for. It's not what these kids are fighting for in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not what we, you know, we went through in terms of Vietnam. We did it so that we can say whatever we want to say whenever we want to say it without fear of reprisal. And for the average everyday guys and girls and just men and women just on the streets of Los Angeles, and all of them had an opinion. Not just if they didn't have an opinion, but so many of them were afraid to be seen on camera. What have we come to? What has happened to what has been undermined here? And it's a real serious question that disturbs me greatly. And that's one of the reasons why I felt someone's got to, you know, do some political theater again and remind people that that's America's great tradition. We put on these shows. We've done it, you know, for our whole history, and not been afraid to, you know, Ben Franklin, you know, wrote articles in the newspaper, and we put on shows, you know, where we question the government, but it hasn't happened in a long time because we seem to be afraid, and that's not what we should be.
Well, and it's not an accident. The repression, the free speech zones, the protest zones, all that. None of that's an accident. This is by design. I think there's little question of that. And probably the fear is, although I hate to see it, I hate to see it expressed in that manner, probably the fear is somewhat an accurate response to some of this.
It's correct.
But who I just finished... I just finished a while ago talking to a gentleman that's done a great deal of study on Thomas Jefferson, and it troubles me to think that were Thomas Jefferson standing beside you when you were out with that camera crew, what he would think. I should think he would have had his head in his hands and gone, oh, my God, what has happened to my country?
That's really well put, Guy. I mean, I agree with 100%. It took me up. It was the most disturbing thing of that whole, you know, couple of days when I was doing all this footage and shooting film of these people. And the thing that shook me up the most was the palpable fear and nervousness about saying what it is you feel in your heart.
Well, I can't say that I've never felt it doing. We do a liberal democratic talk show. We're upfront about it. We don't call ourselves just progressive or anything. I'm a Democrat and I'm a liberal and I express my liberal views. And I can't say that some of that has never come my way. But you just have to deal with it and go on the best you can and hope they're not too damn serious about hanging you or shooting you or whatever they're right. Threatening to do. That's just the way it is. When do you think you're going to have the movie done and ready for viewing?
Well, my plan is we want to shoot it. I would assume somewhere before, you know, maybe it'll be September or something like that. We'll shoot somewhere in that area. And by the time you edit and do all the work and post-production work and all of those things, I want to be out long before the next election. I think we should be out somewhere in it would be nice if we could be out in March, April, you know, something like that.
I really look forward to seeing it. Your work, Bob Greenwald's work, Michael Moore's work. We need more of it. We need the public to be better educated and have a better understanding of what's actually happening to our freedoms in this country. And I really look forward to that. Your website again?
Our website is usvbushmovie.com. And people should send in any questions they feel that the grand jury, members of the grand jury, would ask all of these officials. If you had a chance to sit in the grand jury and speak to some of these officials and ask a question, what would it be?
Great. I hope some of our listeners will do that. I'm planning on doing that myself along with my resume. headshots and the whole, anything beyond that. Yeah. Thanks so much for being on the program today, Robert. I really appreciate it. I look forward to seeing this work, and thank you for what you do.
Well, it's a great privilege to talk to you, and thank you for what you do, too, Guy. It's really important, and we need your voice.
Hope to have you on again some of these days, maybe when you got it all wrapped up.
I'd love to do that.
Thanks. Bye now.
Take care.
Robert Boris, going to make the new movie, U.S. v. Bush, and you all know that story of Elizabeth de la Vega, former federal prosecutor. Should be a great piece of work. The guy's done some tremendous work. Going to have it out before the next election so that it can have an impact. You stop and think right now. His work, Robert Greenwald's work that he's doing, Robert's starting to do a lot of small snippets. Michael Moore's, and I'm going to go see the Michael Moore film tonight. Looking forward to that. Sicko. I'm not sure whether I ought to see it or not. I take an extra blood pressure pill before I go. Kind of involved in a little bit of that insurance thingy myself right now. And so I might not feel too good after I see it. I'm not sure it's a good idea. Hey, listen, I want to thank you for being with us today and every day that you listen to this program. It's a great privilege to come into your homes and talk to you about subjects that I find important and I know that are near and dear to your heart. I think it's important work that we do. There are a lot of good broadcasters around the country, and this network leads the way with progressive liberal talkers that talk about the issues of the day that have to be talked about and must be talked about. And we've ignored some of this all too long. And it's time that our voices are heard. I hope your voices will all be heard loud and long at the White House today. I hope you can let them know. Let me find that number once again if I can here. I probably have put it away. I think I have. I had so much more I wanted to talk about today, but just didn't get time. We had a couple of terrific guests. The White House switchboard and comment line, 202-456-1111. 202-456-1111. Call those people up. Tell them what you think. They should hear what you think. Whether you think it'll do any good or not, let them know what you think. Well, we're like I said, we're down at the end, and I do want to thank you for listening to the program again today. I value your listenership. So many of you, I value your friendship and your donations to the program. I do want to remind everybody that this is a listener-supported program. And that we depend solely on your donations to keep this program going. As you know, we don't have sponsors, and it's not without cost to put on this program every day, and we do what we can to put on a quality program with enough knowledge and expertise to keep you interested every day. So do go to theguyjamesshow.com and donate if you can. We'd appreciate it very much to help keep the lights on and the ink and the printer and all that sort of thing. And we appreciate it very much. I think this has been a good show today. I've enjoyed your comments. I know we're all outraged today, and we needed to express it. I know I needed to express it. I couldn't wait to talk to you today, and I know a lot of you are feeling the same outrage that I am. But, hey, you know, I want to say hello to all my friends over on the Head On Radio Network chat room. The folks in there are a bulwark every day. They're there every day supporting the program, and I appreciate that very much. All you folks over at Democrats.com, all you folks listening on iTunes, thanks for being with us very much. I hope you enjoy the 4th of July tomorrow. I plan to. Regardless of all that's going on, it is still our nation's birthday, and we have an obligation to take this nation back to what it used to be, to the good and grateful and decent nation that it was before this illegal, nasty administration took over. So keep that in mind tomorrow. Don't disdain the festivities of the 4th of July and the birth of our nation just because we've got a group of bastards running it right now. Things will change, and with your help, they will. You are listening to The Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, and it's been a pleasure. Never forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. See you later, gang.